a note. Can we take?
No. Not.
Can we take?
Nope. 1-2, 1-2, we're not on either. Check.
Steve? No.
1-2. Good morning. Good morning. Check.
See if one of these other things works.
Is yours on?
I don't think any of these. Check.
You do the walkthrough. That's fine.
Check. Testing, 1-2, yep. Nothing.
1-2.
Hello?
Hello? Just going to see if maybe we can get the meeting started.
1-2, 1-2, check.
Hello?
Good morning.
Hello.
Good morning. Check. Good morning.
Can we take our seats? We've had
good morning, everyone.
Difficulty. We're trying to get through, but we're going to start.
I think we're on.
Good morning.
I think we're on, Ken.
Test. Yeah. Hello. Are we on? Can we hear? Good. Good morning. Please join us. We had a little technical difficulty. Are we on, Steve? And up and we're up and going, and we're on the screen. Oh, and I hear now. I hear it. Good. Thank you. Good morning, and welcome to our San Rafael soiree of the Regional Stakeholders Group. Good to see you all this morning. We are here in San Rafael starting a full day of the agenda that you'll see that our plan is to break at 11:45 for lunch and to have public comment about 12:30 for public comment. And we do have at least one specific person that we will have at least 5 minutes because of the continuing interaction with the folks at Point Arena, so we have given them 5 minutes to talk, and you have their data that continues, is on the web and was printed for you today, and the resolution from that city council. So we'll talk more about that later, but right now I'll turn it over to Scott McCreary.
Good morning, everyone. Nice to see you all. We saw quite a few of you last week at the Blue Ribbon Task Force meeting in Pacifica. This is a pivotal meeting in the flow of the work of the North Coast Regional Stakeholder Group. You had your round two proposals completed. They've now been evaluated by the SAT relative as well to fish and game feasibility guidance. And we now have as well the feedback from the Blue Ribbon Task Force, which we'll share with you shortly. And so really this is a key moment in the development of the round three proposals. Our meeting objectives today are to receive and discuss these evaluations that I just mentioned. We'll also receive a presentation on a special closures work group that's met twice and has some options in mind for dealing with disturbance issues. We also, as you know, had three public workshops that collectively probably drew well over 300 people. And so we'll hear a summary of those key themes from the workshops. We'll outline the process for developing the final round of MPA proposals, and then we'll plan our next steps, which will include a work session on March 4th and a final meeting of this full regional stakeholder group on March 18th and 19th. And so that is the set of objectives for the meeting, and now my co-facilitator, Eric Poncele, will review the agenda to accomplish those objectives.
Thanks, Darcy, if you could go to the next slide. So the agenda today moves in two main parts. It's going to be very presentation heavy for the rest of this morning and the early part of the afternoon. We're going to be presenting to RSG members the evaluations that have come from the SAT and the Department feasibility and staff evaluations. primarily in the morning. We will have some public comment right after lunch, and then after lunch we'll continue with other presentations that will also include a discussion of the special closures work group and the outcomes of that group and comments received during the public workshops. In the mid-afternoon, we'll have a break, and then we'll come back, and at that point, staff's going to outline for the RSG members the next steps in the proposal development process, and we will initiate that at that point. So that's big picture, and we'll use the very end of the day to kick off next step work to lead us through the work session plan for March 4th, and then our last scheduled RSG meeting on the March 18th and 19th. So with that, why don't we move into some introductions, and I suggest we'll start with Scott and move around the room to the left.
Okay, Scott McCreary, principal of Concur.
Ken Wiseman with the MLPA Initiative.
Darcy Connor with the MLPA Initiative.
Dominic Gregorio with the State Water Board and an SAT member.
Mark Carr, UC Santa Cruz and co-chair of the Science Advisory Team.
Patricia King, I'm Calexa's alternate, but today I'm at the big table and I'm a docent.
Samantha Murray, Ocean Conservancy.
Mike McHenry, Wetfish Industry.
Ken Jones, United Pier and Shore Anglers of California.
Karen Garrison, NRDC.
Josh Churchman, still a fisherman.
Jay Yokomizo, owner-operator, charter boat fishery.
Irina Kogan, Gulf of the Farallon Sanctuary.
Frederick Smith, Executive Director, Environmental Action Committee of West Marin.
Henry Fastenau, University of California, Bodega Marine Lab.
Ellen Farrow Daniels, California Coastal Commission.
Don Neubacher, National Park Service.
Paul Pierce, Coastside Fishing Club, filling in for Ben Sleater today.
Aaron Golbus, Port of San Francisco, representing the California Association of Harbor Masters and Port Captains.
Melissa Miller Henson with the MLPA Initiative.
Susan Ashcraft, Department of Fish and Game.
Jason Vasquez, Department of Fish and Game.
Evan Fox, MLPA Initiative.
Eric Ponsley with Concur, one of the co-facilitators, and maybe we could start with Elizabeth on the side.
Before we do that, you'll notice that Paul Pierce mentioned that Ben Sleater won't be here, and Patricia King mentioned Kellex won't be here. If we have other primary representatives who will not be here, and their alternates are in the room, you should come and sit at the central table if you know that your alternates are not coming today. Thanks.
Elizabeth Pope Smith, Department of Fish and Game.
Stephen Morgan, UC Davis and Bodega Marine Laboratory, co-chair of the Science Advisory Team.
Tom Estes, commercial fisherman.
Tom Beatty, a fisherman from Inverness, an alternate for Craig Merrilee, so I guess I'm moving to the big table.
Russ Herring, Secretary Treasurer, SB Sinkers Club. Bill should be here. I spoke with him earlier. He'll be here with hopefully before noon, he said. So.
Bob Wilson, the Marine Mammal Center.
Rick Johnson, a volunteer docent. Bob Reen should be here mid-morning.
Richard Charter, Defenders of Wildlife.
Philip Sanders, California Abalone Association. I'm not sure if Dirk will be here today or not, so I'll give him a few minutes and then come sit with the big boys and girls.
Nick Tippon, Federated Indians of Great Rancheria. I'm an alternate, and hopefully Nelson will be here.
Neil Desai, National Parks Conservation Association.
Karen Reyna, Gulf of the Farallon Sanctuary.
Christopher Chin, Center for Oceanic Awareness, Research, and Education.
Have we lost our sonic quality here? What's going on? Did we hear from everyone?
Yeah, the sonic quality I understand from Steve was somebody pulled on the cord. So be very careful. And
yes, technology is great, especially when it works. Did we miss anyone for introductions, Cassidy?
Uh,
Cassidy Teufel, California Coastal Commission.
Where's the mat? Where's the mic?
Do we have a portable mic?
I'm Delbra with logistics.
Dennis Mishnick, California Department of Fish and Game.
Matt Erickson, Fish and Game.
All right. We will hear from members of the public when you introduce yourselves for public comment. At this point, we'd like to continue with our agenda, and our first status report is an update from the Science Advisory Team, and Jason Vasquez is on point for that update.
Good morning. So since your last meeting, the SAT has met twice. Their first meeting was on January 8th. They met again on January 23rd, and their next meeting will be April 3rd in Pacifica. So from the January 8th, the highlights of that meeting, the primary objective of that meeting was to support the modeling effort, the parallel processes effort. And so we saw some presentations from the modelers and had quite a bit of discussion on that topic. Additionally, the SAT discussed and approved of a few new methods for evaluating MPA proposals. Those methods included the use of linear versus area calculations for the 0 to 30 hard and soft bottom habitats. It also included the seabird and marine mammals evaluation methods and size and spacing for estuaries. The SAT also viewed various data and discussed at length the levels of protection that should be assigned to salmon trolling in shallow waters. And after a significant discussion, the SAT decided to defer that vote so they could give it further thought during the break. And they deferred that vote until the January 23rd meeting. So at the January 23rd meeting, the SAT deliberated and again discussed the issue of salmon trolling at length. And they decided to vote to keep salmon trolling in waters deeper than 50 meters at a high level of protection. And the SAT placed salmon trolling in waters shallower than 50 meters within a range from high to moderate high. And they noted that this topic was likely going to need a BRTF policy discussion. They also discussed mariculture activities and designated those at a low level of protection, and a few of the other activities like shore fishing, crab fishing, halibut, and striped bass fishing ultimately ended up remaining at the levels of protection they were previously assigned. Also at the January 23rd meeting, the SAT discussed the actual evaluations of the draft MPA proposals. There were a few new evaluations, one of which included seabird and marine mammals. As a side note, one of the evaluations that was not actually presented there, though I give it here so you know it's out there, is the DFG evaluation on abalone management and abalone fishery. The modeling group presented their evaluations of the draft MPA proposals, and at that meeting, they developed a work group to go back and sort of come up with a document that synthesizes the results of the two models. The two models are the UC Davis model and the EDOM model. That document provided insights on how these models can inform MPA evaluations beyond master plan guidance. And some of the language in that is, while different proposals may meet the master plan guidelines, model results can provide subtle differences in trade-offs. And an example of that is when two proposals might have different size or spacings, the model results may reveal which configuration leads to higher sustainability or higher yield, depending on your desire. Lastly, the science questions that come from the RSG to the SAT. You have in your handouts the August 22nd and August 23rd meeting responses, as well as October 16th and 17th responses. And one of your attachments is the November 8th meeting and the December 11th and 12th responses. We won't review those here, but you have those, so please be sure to look through those. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Just so you know, RSG members, so you know what our game plan is here, we have a series of presentations that really hang together as a group, and I think the sort of payoff, if you will, is the SAT evaluation of the proposal. So what I would like to do is try to ask you to hold your questions until we get through that. I know it's a lot of briefings, but what we're up to will make more sense if you can see all the pieces coming together. So thanks very much, Jason. So moving on, our next set of presentations is a BRTF update and the guidance from the Blue Ribbon Task Force. Those of you who were at the Blue Ribbon Task Force no doubt noted that their deliberations were complex and at times, fair to say, I think a little bit meandering. We spent a good deal of time over the last 72 hours putting together, in very close consultation with the Blue Ribbon Task Force, a summary of their guidance. Ken, as you were there at the Blue Ribbon Task Force, do you want to make any framing comments on this before we go into it?
No, I just think that because we had more of a longer statement slash motion, that we felt it was important to double back with the Blue Ribbon Task Force, and because people were reading it different ways, and we wanted to clarify exactly what their intentions were, and that's what Scott has taken the lead on in making sure in preparing this memo that you have, that we sent out last night, and that you have before you the one-page summary. So I think it's real important because this we worked real hard to make this as clarifying as specific as possible for your guidance.
Yeah, I would just add that the Blue Ribbon Task Force actually made two motions that were interrelated, and they made other statements in the form of guidance that were not necessarily expressed as formal motions, and yet we have heard from all of you, both verbally and via email, that you really do need clear guidance from the BRTF in order to do your work, which we agree with. We think that's only fair. And so we worked with them to put together this summary document, which was prepared, as I said, over the last few days, but really finalized yesterday. So if we can look at the PowerPoint. Ken, do you want me to go through this, or do you want to present it? Okay. So I really encourage you to pull out this page-and-a-half document. It says, it's two-sided. It says, summary of MLPA Blue Ribbon Task Force guidance to the North Central Coast Regional Stakeholder Group, and please take a close look at this. So I'm not going to read this exactly verbatim, but pretty close, because I really want you to take this advice on board. The first point is that RSG members should place great weight on the results of the MLPA Master Plan Science Advisory Team evaluations of marine protected area proposals. The next point is very important. In preparing the final round of proposals, RSG members should place strong emphasis on MPAs that meet the SAT guidelines for preferred size and spacing. Very important. Proposals should include MPAs with very high or high levels of protection. The BRTF considers marine reserves to be the backbone of any proposed network. So this is a very key piece of advice. Equally, the BRTF recognizes that proposals may include MPAs with moderate high levels of protection. The BRTF will seriously consider such proposals and will use all SAT evaluated levels of protection when considering MPA alternative proposals and their socioeconomic consequences, as outlined above. Clearly, there are many important ideas here. The reserves as a backbone, the possibility that moderate and high level protection MPAs will be included in proposals, and the consideration of socioeconomic consequences, as well as the consideration of all SAT evaluated levels of protection. So this is advice that all proponents should think very seriously about. Third point, the BRTF deliberated on levels of protection assigned by the SAT to MPAs that allow salmon trolling. Jason just allowed to this, I mean just referred to this. Specifically, the BRTF agreed that MPAs that allow salmon trolling at depths less than 50 meters should be characterized as providing a moderate high level of protection for the North Central Coast. This was quite a deliberation, as those of you who were at the meeting know. In reaching its decision, the BRTF noted that in the SAT evaluation for the Central Coast study region, MPAs allowing salmon trolling in less than 50 meters water depth were assigned a moderate level of protection. The BRTF also recognized that the SAT had reached a split vote on this issue and had noted that this would probably require policy direction from the BRTF. So this is a very important example of where we have a link and a bridge between scientific information, deliberation of the SAT, and a policy decision, and the BRTF stepped up and made a policy decision as they needed to do. Fourth point is the BRTF stressed that cross-interest support is very important. Those of you who made presentations to the BRTF recall that there was a lot of interest in who was an author of the various proposals, what kind of cross-interest support does a proposal have. You all need to take this very much to heart. A proposal that has the support of only one interest group is not likely to meet this guidance. And so, regardless of where a proposal started out or who some of the main authors are, every one of the proposals that goes forward into round three needs broad cross-interest participation in building it and hopefully supporting it at the end of the day in March. The BRTF asked that in March the RSG forward no more than three alternative MPA proposals, where there are currently five proposals. And as again, they applauded the cross-interest work and asked that you continue to strive for convergence. Point six, the BRTF asked that members give strong consideration to the Department of Fish and Game feasibility guidelines. They also asked that if proposals deviate from the Fish and Game feasibility guidelines, that there be a very clear rationale. So if there is some kind of meandering line or some kind of a MPA shape that does not meet the feasibility guidelines, there ought to be a very good reason for that, and it should be made explicit. Okay, so the final point that they considered were the merits of including recommendations for special closures for marine bird and marine mammal protection, and they talked about this at some length. They had several pieces of advice. One is that in developing final proposals, the focus should be on MPAs rather than on special closures, as your primary charge is to implement the Marine Life Protection Act. But the BRTF also recognized that in some instances, special closures may offer the kind of geographically specific protection that are not addressed as effectively from MPAs. So their advice was, please keep the focus on completing proposals on MPAs, but you may elect to include recommendations for special closures. Special closures should be used sparingly and selectively, and they also acknowledge that work on this set of options for special closures is not done, and so therefore, very likely a special closures work group needs to meet again, and we'll address that later in the meeting. So that is the body of advice from the Blue Ribbon Task Force. Again, this document was prepared in very close consultation with all five BRTF members and represents their collective views of what their guidance was at the meeting. Ken, Melissa, do you want to add anything to that? Okay. All right, so let that sink in, and we'll continue. And the next piece of guidance is from the Department of Fish and Game, Susan Ashcraft. Uh-oh. She is deliberating. Very internally, yes.
It's a good grape. Actually, I thought I was third.
Yeah. I'm sorry.
List.
My apologies.
Is this right?
Where am I, Eric? Help me out.
No, this is right. No, this is right. Okay. No, that's correct. I would like to point out to the regional stakeholder group members, one of the other things that the Blue Ribbon Task Force did at their meeting was to adopt the regional goals and objectives for the study region.
Thank you.
With one minor clarification, it was a design consideration in identifying MPAs that could be used for comparison purposes with reserves with differing levels of that these MPAs would have differing levels of extractive activities so that they could be compared against reserves to for long-term monitoring and evaluation for determining how different levels of protection, in fact, from a management perspective, bear out.
Thank you.
Okay.
Susan.
Now I'm ready. So I'm going to provide you with an update of the department's guidance with respect to feasibility analysis. And I'm not going to go into the feasibility analysis. That's going to happen later today on the agenda. So do we have a clicker, or am I asking for the next slide? Oh, no, not again.
Darcy can be your clicker, though.
Okay. Darcy, you want to be my clicker? Okay. So the topics I'll cover right now refer to the updated memo that we provided on feasibility criteria to help to clarify some of the issues that came up in specific areas by the members of the RSG, reference to a memo that the department produced on private lands and how they interact with marine protected areas, and also guidance on some special conditions that are included in your feasibility analysis. So as a quick reminder for those that may not be familiar, the existing memorandum of understanding between the department, the Resources Agency, and the Resources Legacy Fund Foundation require that the department prepare a statement of what feasibility criteria it will use to evaluate MPA proposals and provide recommendations and comment to the Fish and Game Commission. So the RSG received these in a June 11th memo that detailed these to help support you in developing your proposals. Some issues emerged that might be considered special circumstances. So on February 11th, the department provided you with an updated memo, and that was mailed out. So some of the issues that were clarified are that in conditions for floating corners, now the feasibility guidelines from the department have originally said that these should fall on whole minutes of latitude or longitude, and we want to clarify that that is what's optimal, and but there's kind of an order of preference of priority that if that's not possible, given other considerations, half minutes would be next in line, and then if you can't get that, at least get to a tenth minute, which is as least preferred. Moving on to the issue of diagonal lines, there were a lot of areas where the coastline is quite angled in this part of the coast, and so in those circumstances, diagonal lines may be appropriate when they follow the angles of the coastline. Now, that would up the expectations for what latitude or longitude they would fall on, and those really should be anchored at a whole minute, either at latitude or longitude, so that it's a lot easier and clear to the public where those boundaries lie. With respect to distance offshore, previously enforcement had given us input that distance offshore from islands would be acceptable if it was a half mile, a mile, and what have you. Enforcement met and consulted and started evaluating things a little bit more closely, and they've clarified that that's actually quite difficult for them to enforce, and the reason it was effective down in the Channel Islands is because that boundary distance offshore is at the 3 mile limit, so that anywhere in that area they knew that it was within their jurisdiction to enforce, and so they've clarified that indeed either use a corner and with the floating corners guidelines or extend it out to 3 miles. We have had public comment and questions specifically about private lands and how they may interact with MPAs that are sited adjacent to them. The department prepared a memo to the RSG on January 31st called Private Land Ownership and Marine Protected Areas, and I just call your attention to it again in this forum. It addresses questions of private ownership of land adjacent to MPAs. It addresses issues of access to MPAs through private lands and the issue of marine stewardship on MPAs that would be and how that's accomplished when it's adjacent to private lands. And that's all covered, but it's available, and it's on our website as well, I believe. So I want to talk about some special conditions that that will help you. These are updates to questions that have come up in the past. The first one is on aquaculture leases. We heard from legal and the department that mariculture would not necessarily constitute take in the legal sense of the word, but MLPA requirements and go beyond just take. They also have to do with disturbance of bottom habitat and other ecosystem issues. And so this update is that if a proposal is going to include a state marine reserve or something intended to be a state marine reserve, but it overlaps where there's an existing aquaculture lease, then go ahead and change that designation to a state marine conservation area with just one specific allowance provision for allowing the mariculture to continue. And if the RSG is recommending that that area be reconsidered for designation as a state marine reserve when the lease expires and you have recommendations specific to that, put those recommendations in your documentation so that that's reflected. But the RSG and the doesn't have any authority over making recommendations to change an existing lease right now. Okay? The next one is on waterfowl hunting. There are some areas where different types of designations are being proposed, and such as mostly state marine reserves, but in one case there's an existing state marine park, and enforcement has brought it to our attention that waterfowl hunting occurs in some of those areas. So the department recommends that the best designation to propose is a state marine recreational management area, SMRMA, and if that is the, you can be specific that waterfowl hunting may continue despite other restrictions on take. Several existing MPAs, after reevaluation, you've included them in your MPA network proposals. And so two things that have shown up are issues with boundaries of existing boundaries that many of the existing shapes don't meet DSG feasibility criteria. I know you have a number of reasons for possibly keeping a state marine park boundary, but we want to note that that's something that you should take a look at. Also, regulations, a lot of existing marine protected areas in the study region have highly complex regulations. And during this last iteration, please take a look at those and simplify. And we're willing to work with you to help craft regulations either that reflect what was intended originally or that better match goals and objectives that now you will be linking to those marine protected areas as they're reauthorized, or if they are. And that's it for this stage, and I'll go into some examples of those and other analyses later.
Thank you very much. Is there a second part of your presentation, Susan?
Yes, it's part of the afternoon agenda.
So let's move on and turn to Dominic Gregorio. Dominic, I want to personally apologize to you for inviting you and then disinviting you about four times to these meetings. I had a lot to do with that since I sort of figure out the flow of these meetings. So thank you for your patience and your expertise. We're finally putting you on.
Well, thank you. I don't know if this is working.
It is.
It is.
Pull it closer to you. Now.
Okay. I get that a lot, so don't feel bad.
We're glad you're here.
So I'll try to be brief. The PowerPoint that I'll be working from is, I believe, on the web, and also a companion document that goes along with it. And so I'll ask you to refer to that for more detailed information. You can always give me a call or get a hold of me via email if you have questions.
And note the date at the top of the presentation.
Yeah, that's an artifact of
documents 24 and 25 of your attachments.
Okay, thank you.
Yes.
So next slide, please. So what you see there is a lot of laws and regulations and reference to permit conditions. And that's about all I'm going to say about that, except for if you notice partway down there, enclosed bays and estuaries plan, sediment quality objectives. I just want to make a quick announcement that the state of California just this week, my group at the State Water Board was successful in getting the first sediment quality objectives in the United States adopted. And those apply, again, to enclosed bays and estuaries. So next slide. Or I guess I have the clicker. Okay. One of the standards that was referred to on the previous slide had to do with the California Ocean Plan. Those are our water quality standards for the exposed coastline of the state. And specifically within the Ocean Plan, there are objectives, Table B objectives, which are really of two different kinds. There's a group of objectives that have to do with marine life protection, and that includes metals, toxicity, and a few other constituents. There are also objectives that relate to human health through bioaccumulation. Relatively speaking, I would say about two-thirds of the Table B objectives have to do more directly with human health, about one-third with marine life protection. And we're always trying to update the Ocean Plan, and one of the things that I want to point out is that these objectives currently don't include a lot of emerging contaminants, endocrine disruptors, etc. But we're starting to work on that now. Another thing to mention is that we operate under the Clean Water Act in California. We're authorized to administer that that law and the regulations. And one of the requirements is that we list all of the water body segments that do not meet standards, including in ocean waters, the standards that are in the Ocean Plan. The last list for the 303D listings was in 2006, and that's also available on the internet, and I'll go over a little bit of those results here in a bit. One thing I did want to mention is in the Ocean Plan, we have what we call areas of special biological significance. Under the Public Resources Code, those are also referred to as state water quality protection areas, and those are one of the six types of marine managed areas. Of course, not an MPA, but there are three other types of marine managed areas that are not MPAs. These are one of those. And in these, either ASBSs or SWQPAs, depending on what law you're looking at, waste discharges are prohibited in these areas. A while back, we did a study and found that we had about 1,658 discharges, to our surprise, in the ASBSs. And we're now working to reduce the wastes from those discharges. And I think we've got a pretty successful program underway to address those. So these are the ASBSs or SWQPAs in the current study region. I think there's about 10 of them. Many of them are co-located with the current MPAs in the area. And one thing I did want to mention, I mentioned a companion document. So in that companion document, which I'm not going to go over right now, but I wanted to tell you that there are reasons why each of these ASBSs were designated in the 1970s. They're specifically related to biological communities and habitat conditions that were relatively unique or considered important enough to be protected. So you could take a look at that at your leisure, and it will explain why these ASBSs were established. Another thing is I did provide the team a set of maps that relate to specific water quality features. And I'm not sure if that got posted. Those maps got posted directly. They're in the PowerPoint here, but they might be hard to see in the PowerPoint. And I just wanted to make everybody aware that I have been working with the I-team on those maps. And these are, you'll see the maps in the PowerPoint as you look at it. So I had it broken down, I think, into two or three sections of coastline. So this is just a list of the impaired waters in our regional water board one. We have two regional boards in your study area, the North Coast Regional Board, which we call Region 1, and then the San Francisco Bay Regional Board, which is Region 2. So these are impaired waters in the northern subregions that you've been working with. And you can see a lot of those are related to temperature and sediment. In other words, they don't meet the standards. There are some wastewater plants in your region, and one of those is at Anchor Bay. It's a very small discharge, but it happens to be located right on the shoreline. Another source of pollutants into the marine waters is the Russian River watershed. Fairly large city, Santa Rosa, is located there. There's a sewage treatment plant that empties into that, and also stormwater from the Santa Rosa area. You've probably heard of mussel watch. Just to let you know, there's a very, very limited state mussel watch program that still remains. I think it's only about 12 or 13 sites along the entire coast. That was one of the sort of casualties of some budget cuts a few years ago. But NOAA still has a very strong mussel watch program in the state. And recently, the State Water Board and SQIRP have partnered with NOAA to increase the number of sites that we have now for monitoring mussel watch. So we're trying to invigorate mussel watch really as a partnership between NOAA and the state. And I'm not going to go through all of these elevated pollutant levels. You could look at those on the PowerPoint. Now, moving down the coast, you enter into Regional Water Board 2. That's the San Francisco Bay area. And one area I wanted to concentrate on was Tomales Bay. You can see there for Tomales Bay, mercury shows up both at Walker Creek, which empties into the bay, and in Tomales Bay proper. And those were impairments. You can see in the mussel watch data, mercury also shows up at Walker Creek and Lagunitas Creek. And here's some data that I'll just refer you to. I won't go through it in any detail, but the higher mercury concentrations in the sediments and in the bivalves are both at the mouth of Walker Creek. In that same location, here's some mercury concentrations in the invertebrates that are found there. You can see it's elevated. And then for the fish that feed in the benthic environment, particularly on invertebrates, you see higher levels of mercury as well. So there's bioaccumulation of mercury in Tomales Bay. So moving down the coast now, the area adjacent to San Francisco, and there are impaired waters in this general area. I realize that San Francisco Bay is not specifically in your study area, but it drains to your study area, so it's important to mention here. And we have a sanctuary, and the Gulf of Farallon's being located right off of the coast of San Francisco. Some things to mention: we all know about oil spills in San Francisco Bay and how they can affect offshore waters. There is a radioactive dump site that's south of the Farallon Islands. The sanctuary does prohibit sewage discharges, but there is a donut hole, what they call a donut hole, where the San Francisco City's outfall is located. And I'll go over that in a little bit more detail in a bit. So I mentioned mercury in Tomales Bay, but in San Francisco Bay it's also a problem. And you can see that the levels in San Francisco Bay for fish tissue are at least as high or higher as the Tomales Bay levels. Now, what you're looking at here is an assessment that we recently did as part of the development of the sediment quality objectives. So we used three lines of evidence, which is the benthic community. It's essentially an advanced form of diversity measurements in the benthic community, chemistry and toxicity. And you'll see, look up at Tomales Bay, and you can see that it's not really impacted in terms of the effect on benthic communities. But if you look at San Francisco Bay, the yellows, the browns, the reds, those are areas that are either possibly or likely or clearly impacted. That means that the benthos, the benthic community, is affected by pollution in San Francisco Bay. So as we get lots of outflow from San Francisco Bay, it's the biggest outflow in the state, into marine waters, you know, it's carrying those pollutants with it. And here's just a slide showing you the direction of the currents coming out of San Francisco Bay, and it goes to the north and the south, and it's really, I was provided this by John Largier, so if you have any questions on this, I'd refer those questions to him. But the bottom line is that there are seasonal changes in the outflow from the bay. It could go north, it could go south. So this is specifically on the San Francisco ocean outfall. It's located 3.7 miles from the mainland, and a lot of people think, well, it's way out there, not a problem. But when it rains a lot in San Francisco, it discharges on the shore. And when it rains a lot, it also doesn't treat any of that discharge. So it's rare. It happens a few times of the year maybe. But just be aware that although there's an outfall way out there, it's an allowed combined sewer overflow, which means it includes both the stormwater and the sewage. What's important, though, that I wanted to really emphasize is that the city of San Francisco has an extensive ocean monitoring program where they measure bacteria, chemistry, benthic and fish communities, bioaccumulation. I'll let you look at the results on your own, but the bottom line is that there are some elevated chemical levels in the sediments at the mouth of San Francisco Bay, kind of mirroring what we saw on the interior of the bay. And it might not necessarily be related to the discharge from San Francisco's sewage system. It might just be the general outflow from the bay. And so it's just something to think about. There are a couple of other sewage plants in the general vicinity. There's the North San Mateo Wastewater Treatment Plant and the Sewer Authority Mid-Coastside Treatment Plant. Those both discharge maybe a little less than a half a mile from shore, but they're much smaller than San Francisco, the city of San Francisco's outfall. And my last slide has to do with sea otters. So there is, I know, an interest by some groups that that sea otters move up the coast and become reestablished up the coast from their present range. I understand that there are some recent data that show that the sea otters are tending in that direction. But one of the problems that we found in the Monterey Bay area is that we've had confirmed mortalities from pathogens. So normally you think of bacteria and pathogens as being a standard that relates more to human health. But in this case, it can be an indicator of sewage and other fecal matter, and not just human, but oriented from cats and other terrestrial animals. And we've had confirmed mortalities from that, particularly for T. gondii, which is a parasite in cat feces. Also, there have been, I think now, four confirmed mortalities from microcystin. And microcystin is a toxin found in blue-green algae. So as the blue-green algae grow in watersheds, those get released during storms, and those toxins can affect the otters. That's the end of the slides. I did want to make the point that as, you know, you consider your MPA strategies and where you want to place the MPAs. I don't think water quality should necessarily be something that you consider strongly at this point, but you should be aware of some of these issues. And especially after these MPAs are established, I think what's key is that monitoring is going to be important. And to develop partnerships with the water quality monitoring would be very helpful. There's two examples. One is that San Francisco monitoring program, which extends over a large area of your study region. That's going to be really important to partner with them, I believe. And also in the ASBSs, we're starting a monitoring program in the ASBSs. Those are more nearer shore, and I think that it would be important to partner there as well. So that's my presentation.
Thank you very much, Dominic, and very, very excellent overview, very concise, and you covered the whole geography well, so thank you very much. I want to suggest that we would be well served by moving on into the staff and SAT evaluation, and that we ought to proceed with that. Again, as my sense is, these really hang together as a set of proposals. So, Dominic, thank you very much. There may be questions for you offline, but I'm kind of eager to press on. Thank you. So we're going to turn next then to Evan Fox, who is going to give a staff overview of the portion of the evaluation handled by staff, and then we'll hear from Mark Carr, who with Steve Gaines has done a lot of extraordinarily heavy lifting in developing both methods and applying them in the SAT evaluation.
So, great.
No. So, Evan, you're okay. On.
Great. Thanks a lot, Scott. If we could get the PowerPoint up there, that'd be good. And if I could have that clicker from Dominic, that'd be great. So, over the last couple weeks, the RSG has received a whole bunch of different kinds of evaluations, and I know it's been a lot coming at you and a lot to digest, and what I want to do is kind of give you a little bit of a overview here of the different kind of evaluations that you've received and group them into three different categories. So basically, there are those evaluation summaries that are produced by the MLP Initiative staff, and those are there up on top in blue. And then there's those that are managed by the Department of Fish and Game, and then those that are managed by the Science Advisory Team and produced by the Science Advisory Team. And so what we're going to do is we're going to focus just right now on the staff summaries and evaluations, and we'll go later into the Department of Fish and Game and SAT materials. And I should point out that all of these materials are in your packets, so though we're not going to go into detail in them, you can review the details later and use them in your evaluations. Okay, so the first thing we're going to talk about are these proposal templates, and you guys are all very familiar with this. This is a collaborative effort between the regional stakeholder group and also the staff. And I've put up here on the screen all the different components of these templates, and I think you're all very familiar with it. And I just want to point out a couple things that are going to be different in the third iteration of MPA proposals. So the first is this rationale for your proposal. And this is something that we've kind of touched on in the past, but in the round three, we really want to make sure we get a good handle on. And so for each one of these proposals, we want to make sure we have a good feeling for what your rationale, what your thinking is behind these. And this is at a broad scale, looking, you know, kind of across all your different MPA concepts. And it's things like who's involved in it, what are the kind of trade-offs that have been considered, and what's kind of the genesis of your proposal. And that's, you know, something that's less than a page, but maybe more than a paragraph. So, and then kind of on the more individual MPA level, there are three different things that I want to point out for all of you. The first is that with regard to MPA boundaries, we're going to have to be a little bit more specific in this next round about making sure that we talk about specific latitude and longitude lines for each of the edges of your MPAs. And this is because we want to make sure we give the Department of Fish and Game a good basis for evaluating the draft the proposals based on feasibility criteria. So we're going to be a little better on that. The second are the allowed and disallowed uses, and we just have to make sure that we are a little more specific in a couple different areas. The first is kind of talking about, when you're talking about take, making sure that you specify whether you're talking about recreational and or commercial take. And for each MPA, saying whether whatever species you're talking about, whether you're talking about the recreational or the commercial side of it. The next is talking about individual species. So in the past, you might say something like, we want to allow crab in this area. And you should really think about whether you're talking about all crab species, you know, rock crab and Dungeness crab and et cetera, or whether you're just talking about Dungeness crab. So to the extent possible and in line with whatever your thinking is, you should just be specific about what species you're talking about. The third part is looking at your specific gear restrictions. And you actually have been very good so far about when you're talking about salmon, specifying whether you're talking about salmon trolling or salmon mooching or other activities. And you should carry that over into other things such as hook and line or other gear restrictions that you might be, or shore fishing, other things that you're specific about. So I think that's really important. That'll really help us in the next round. And so the final thing that I want to highlight here is the comments section. And this is going to be really important in this round. As was mentioned in a couple of the presentations so far, there are situations in which you might not meet feasibility or science guidelines in an MPA. And the comment section is really your opportunity to go in there and say, this is why. You know, give an explanation why. And this is something that the BRTF, as Scott mentioned, has requested, is that you provide the rationale for why you're not meeting it, and they will consider that. So that's kind of the templates. The other kind of evaluations that the staff does are kind of basic information pieces on the draft arrays. So these are things like the raw habitat calculation numbers, the size of MPAs, and the spacing of MPAs. And we've kind of done things like grouping these into various levels of protection and giving some basic information. And I just want to pause here and really thank the co-leads for each of the draft proposals for helping us error check these, because we came up with these draft evaluations, we sent them out, and we wanted to make sure they were correct so that the science advisory team really had a good basis from which to do their evaluations. So thank you to all the co-leads for helping us to error check those, do some quality control. Okay, so moving on. So we have those basic evaluations or basic data that we produce, and we've kind of grouped them in a very simple way into a couple different things that I think are useful for the regional stakeholder group. And by now, you're very familiar with these graphs. These are area histograms that compare each of the draft proposals by area, looking at both designation, as shown on this slide, and then also by level of protection. So it's just a way to kind of compare in a broad scale various draft proposals. And another way to kind of look at that broad scale comparison are the side-by-side maps, which I think are new in this round. You guys haven't seen these yet, but basically, in any given geography, you can use these side-by-side maps and the regulations to look at specific MPA configurations and also look at the specific regulations that are proposed in different areas. So it just gives you another tool for comparing draft arrays. The final thing that I want to talk about is the Goal 3 analysis. Now, Goal 3 is a goal of the Marine Life Protection Act, and it's something that's not necessarily evaluated in other areas. So the staff has gone and looked at how MPAs affect recreational, educational, and study opportunities. And you have all received a very detailed document that goes through and compares all these different things and looks at how MPAs, how their proximity to access points, to ports and harbors, to research institutions, and also things like replication for the purpose of looking at study opportunities. So kind of to sum things up here, the staff summaries and analyses are basic information. The SAT uses all these as a basis for their more complicated analyses, and they really help you look at basic comparisons at a broad level between the different draft proposals. And finally, we've done the Goal 3 analysis, which is an MLPA goal and is important to consider, but is not necessarily addressed in other analyses. So that's it.
Thanks very much, Evan. What I'd like to do now is to move on to Mark Carr. Mark has been a very key member of our science advisory team, was very instrumental in developing the size and spacing methodology in the Central Coast, and has been has graciously agreed to continue in the North Central Coast. And he and Steve Gaines have been working closely. If you went to the BRTF meeting last week, you know that Steve Gaines gave a version of this presentation, maybe the same exact one. Yes? Same exact one. Mm-hmm. So we'll get to hear how it sounds different when Mark Carr gives it, exactly. If at all. You're on. The long-awaited SAT evaluation.
Right. Thanks, Scott. Can you guys hear me okay? So again, as Scott mentioned, what I want to do is try and cover all the various aspects of the SAT evaluations that were recently conducted. And that includes the habitat representation analyses, habitat replication. We're also going to touch on some new bits on birds and mammals, just a couple of slides, but you've all received a more detailed summary of the evaluation for bird and mammal habitats. And then move to size and spacing analyses, including some of the results that were generated by the new models that the science advisory team has been developing. So to do that, however, let's ground it back in the broad overarching goals of the MLPA. And those six are listed for reference here. And all of you have the handout of this presentation. So I suggest that you follow the talk with this, and you can make notes and questions on this handout. And of these six overarching goals, two of those pertain largely to habitat protection, ecosystem-wide protection. The first is to protect the functions, the diversity of species. And to do that, we realize that different habitats protect different kinds of species. And hence, goal four indicates the necessity to protect representative and unique habitats. So the evaluation of each of the proposals required these responding to these three questions, the first of which is how well are the key habitats represented in each of the proposed MPA networks? What are the proposed levels of protection for each of those habitat types? And then how well are those habitats and levels of protections distributed across the study region? And again, on the handout, you'll have this summary of the levels of protections. And this is important to have in hand because as we go through the different proposals and you see how the different areas are protected at different levels of protection, you can use this as a reference to see some of the activities corresponding to those different levels. And then the earlier, Scott and Jason, I think, referred to the Blue Ribbon Task Force decision on the shallow salmon trolling level of protection. So I want to start, again, as usual, trying to lay out sort of the broad similarities across all the different packages. And there are several similarities that are common to each of the packages that were proposed. The first one is in the similarities in the number and the location of MPAs, as well as the particular habitats that they include. Excuse me. And if you look at the different maps, you'll see that there's a lot of convergence across the proposals where these MPAs are located up and down the coast. Having said that, however, the size of the MPAs at each of those locations vary markedly, right? And so here's just a quick example where the State Marine Reserve off of Salt Point for Proposal 1, in contrast to a similar MPA proposed by Proposal 2. And this second one also illustrates the common design among many of the packages where you have an inshore state marine reserve with an offshore state marine conservation area, usually designed to allow salmon fishing, salmon trolling, or crabbing offshore in deeper waters. And then the clusters of the MPAs with this inshore and offshore design is common throughout the study region, throughout each of the three subregions. One of the again, which we saw, I think, in the first set of proposals as well, is that the shoreline and shallow habitats, for the most part, are generally well represented in very high-level protection MPAs. And you'll see this as we move into these examples, the graphs of the different levels of protection. Another similarity across the packages is that the estuarine habitats, again, were really well represented, again, in very high protection MPAs. And most of the proposals still tend to protect a greater proportion of the habitats in the southern subregion. In other words, they tended to target Drake's Estero more so than the estuaries to the north. But in addition to that, one thing that we see in the second round is also greater attention to these smaller estuaries that occur up and down the coast. And so a lot of those smaller estuaries, especially in the northern region, were identified. And so those add additional estuarine conservation area. And that was, again, common across most of the packages. So before we remember, we're going to look at a lot of graphs that show the percent of these different habitats at each of the different levels of protection. You have to recognize that those percentages need to be weighed by the relative absolute value of each of those habitats in the region, right? And so this next slide that you have depicts the relative abundance of each of the different habitats in each of the three subregions. So take a look at that legend down at the very base of these figures. You'll see that red is indicated for the Farallons. The south is in green. Is the south in green and the blue's in north up there? And comparing the relative height of the green and the blue gives you an idea of the relative availability of these habitats in those subregions. So, for example, the one that really stands out in the upper figure is the deep, soft bottom habitat is the most abundant by far in all of the three different subregions, including the Farallon Islands. There's more rocky shore and shallow rocky reef in the north subregion, as you recall. And again, that's illustrated by the greater amount of blue up here relative to green. And there's more shallow soft bottom in the south region. And kelp only shows up in the north region here at the end of the first graph. And that's to some extent because we just have trouble mapping its pattern, its abundance in the southern region. And then there's more estuarine area in the north. Now we're focused on that lower graph that shows at the very far left the total estuary area. And then... okie dokie. Is that working over there too? Yep, good. The bar to the far left shows the total estuary habitat, and then each of these are habitats within the estuary. The eelgrass, marsh, and tide flat. And we've calculated marsh both by square miles and by linear miles because it, in different habitats or different estuaries, it was more accurate. It could be more accurately depicted depending on what you're using. So what you tend to see, again, is that there's a lot more estuarine environment in the north relative to the south, and especially eelgrass habitat. Let's see now. Is this going to... Okay, carrying on again for further more similarities, the estuarine habitats, as I mentioned, are generally well represented in very high protection MPAs, and most of the... No, we already did this, didn't we? Where are we going here? There. Okay, now let's get into the actual comparisons for each habitat type. So this is the shoreline shallow habitats, right? The top graph is surf grass. The middle graph is rocky reef. Rocky intertidal shoreline. And then the bottom is the sandy beach. And right off the bat, you can see that all of the proposals tend to include quite a bit of this habitat type in high levels of protection in no-take state marine reserves. So, for example, most of them are at least 20% for rocky shore and surf grass. And if you look at the comparison between the packages, one thing to do is to think about running a line on, is this working? There we go. You can sort of run a line across here, thinking about what's the average amount across these packages, and you'll see repeatedly that for proposals 1, 3, and 4, they tend to be above the average, and proposals 2 and the external proposal tend to be below that. That's the case for the surf grass, for the rocky shore, and for the sandy beach. Again, as before, the sandy beach tends to be less protected. I mean, in other words, less area set aside for sandy beach relative to the amount of rocky habitat that's set aside. And that's despite the fact that there tends to be pretty similar amounts of that habitat. That's given in the parentheses here for rocky shore and sandy beach. And it's really a reflection, I think, across all the packages for a focus on protecting rocky habitat, the greater diversity of species associated with, and the high fidelity of species associated with that habitat type. It's going the other way. Okie doke. And now moving slightly offshore into the rocky habitat, the shallow rocky reefs with the kelp, and then the deeper rocky reef habitat. And the top graph shows kelp, the middle graph shows shallow rock reef, and the bottom graph is the deep rock reef. So again, As we saw in the shallower rocky habitats, a high proportion of the protected areas that were proposed are in these no-take state marine reserves. So in other words, take a look at each one of those bars, and each one of those bars tends to be dominated by red, indicating that most of the MPAs are set aside as no-take reserves. You'll notice that the patterns that you see across the proposals for kelp generally reflects that for shallow rocky reef. And again, if you draw a line across these packages down through the middle to kind of look at sort of the average level across the packages, you see that 1, 3, and 4 tend to be above the average, 2 and the external package below the average. And specifically, the package number 4 tends to put a greater amount of area aside in MPAs relative to all of the other packages. And this will be important when we actually talk about some of the modeling results. Notice that above and beyond the amount of area that's set aside as no-take reserves, then people also put aside MPA areas in conservation areas at either high, especially in the deep rock area, and or moderate high protection, allowing salmon or crabbing in MPAs that were in deeper waters offshore. In the shallower habitats, the shallow rocky reef, there's that additional area that's set aside as moderate and low protection. And that moderate tent generally reflects the allowance of abalone fishing, and the lower designation reflects areas that were set aside allowing urchin harvesting. Now turning to the soft bottom habitat representation. Again, as I mentioned before, there's, like the sandy beach, the shallow sand habitat offshore tends to be represented in less area relative to those rocky reef habitats. But again, the area that is set aside in each one of the proposals tends to be set aside in no-take state marine reserves, and therefore very high protection levels. Some of those shallow areas are in moderate high protection because they include larger MPAs that come inshore that allow crabbing and salmon trolling, shallow salmon trolling. With respect to the deep sand, large areas of the deep sand, in addition to the no-take reserve, are set aside in high protection because they're allowing salmon trolling in near the surface. And moderate high levels of protection because they're allowing crabbing in many of those protected areas. But again, notice if you look across the average level of, say, no take or all MPA area set aside, for the most part, at least at the moderate high level or the high level, you see that packages 1, 3, and 4 are above that average, and packages 2 and external package are below that. And remember that these levels are low, the percentages are low for deep sand because the absolute amount of habitat that's out there is really large. Shifting to estuarine habitats, as I mentioned in the summary, large proportions are set aside in no-take state marine reserves. And the addition or exception to the general trend across those is the inclusion of moderate high SMCA in package 3, which allows crabbing, and then moderate levels of protection in the external package because they're accommodating, they're allowing the aquaculture, mariculture activities in Drake's Estero. But otherwise, you see general similarity across many of the packages. So in summary, with respect to habitat representation, there's definitely some convergence that's occurred from the initial suite of proposals in this suite, right? There's definitely convergence in the relative amount and the levels of protection that are being proposed. With the exception of the estuarine habitats, which, as I said, are very similar across many of the packages, the proposals differed consistently across habitats in the area protected, especially in very high protection. And that was proposal 4 tended to be higher than 1 and 3, which tended to be higher than 2 and the external, all of which, of course, were much higher than the status quo, the current MPAs that are out there. Many of the habitats are well represented in high levels of protection, and the habitats varied markedly in the allowed uses that the different proposals allowed. And so that reflected the different allocations of different kinds of fishing activities across the MPAs. And then the last bit is the soft habitats still relative to their, even relative to their availability, tend to be represented less than the rocky reef habitats. Okay, so now we're going to turn to size and spacing. And remember, these the size and spacing guidelines and evaluations really are focused at achieving the second and sixth goal, which the idea is to make sure that we can contribute to sustainable populations in the region, and for that purpose, ensuring that the MPA network is actually networked. But before we do that, I want to make a quick comment when we talk about the location and size of these MPAs with reference to the latest component of the evaluation process, and that's with respect to marine birds and marine mammals. And so I just want to take a couple of slides here, and as I mentioned earlier, you have a big, more detailed summary of the bird and mammal evaluation. But if we look at the three components of the bird conservation objectives, and that's to protect colonies, roosts, and foraging areas, we've broken it down by the three subregions, north, south, and the Farallones. And the details are in here, but generally what you tend to see is the proposals 3, especially in the north, and 1 and 4 in the south, and in the Farallones, again, 1, 3, and 4, tend to target greater areas, greater numbers of and species of for breeding colonies. With respect to seabird roosts, in the north, it's, again, proposal 3. In the south, proposal 1. And in the Farallones, again, proposals 1, 3, and 4, and external A include the greatest number of roost habitats in their protected areas. And then finally, with respect to foraging areas, it's the draft proposal 3 rated the highest, and draft proposal 2 had the least amount of area set aside with respect to bird foraging areas. Okay, and then now turning quickly to the marine mammals. Again, there's two components. There's protection of the rookeries, and there's protection of their haul-out areas, and we've again divided that up by the three subregions. In the north, all of the draft proposals included somewhere around 23% of the pinniped rookeries, except for draft proposal 3. In the south, draft proposals 1 and 3 included over 90% of the rookeries. And then out at the Farallones, draft, again, proposals 1, 3, and 4 included all four species of breeding pinnipeds. Draft proposal 2 was none of them, and the external proposal included a couple. So 1, 3, and 4, again, tend to incorporate more area for rookery habitat. For haul-out, a similar pattern again. It ranged from 8% to 19% in proposals 3 and 1. The draft proposals 1, 3, and 4 included 80% of the pinniped areas in the south. And then out on the Farallones, all the draft proposals included over 96%, essentially 100% of the pinniped haul-out areas. And so that's all I'm going to say about the bird and mammal evaluation. and you have a much more detailed summary of that that's been provided to you today. So now turning to the size analysis, again, I want to refresh you with the criteria that we use. Remember, we measure the individual MPA lengths and area, and then we combine those contiguous MPAs. For example, remember we had some of the inshore SMRs and the offshore SMCAs. Those are grouped into a common area. And then you'd consider the level of protection for each of the MPAs, and then tabulate the lengths and areas relative to the minimum and preferred guidelines. And so that's where we're going with this next set of figures, which plot each of the MPAs for each of the proposals on the vertical axis with respect to whether they're below the minimum, at the minimum, or in that preferred range from left to right across this figure. And now this is important, we're going to do that from the very high to the moderate high levels of protection. And you'll see how MPAs tend to move into the higher size ranges as we consider lower levels of protection, right? So this is starting at the very highest level of protection. These are all the state marine reserves. There's a couple for package 4 and 1 that are way up in the preferred range. But generally speaking, it's only packages 4 and 3 that have a reasonable number at the minimum size guideline. The majority package, the external package and 2 and 1 tend to have the majority of their MPAs below that minimum size. Now, as we consider the high level of protection as well as the very high, right, you see a lot of these MPAs shifting now toward that minimum level. Especially now package 4 has 3 of their MPAs up in the preferred range. And for the most part packages 4 and 3 and to a lesser extent 1 have packages at that minimum size, whereas the external and package 2 have 1 of all of their MPAs now at that minimum size range, okay? So you see a gradual shift into the minimum size, but you still see this consistent difference between 1, 3, and 4 versus the external and 2. And then when we now consider the moderate to high, now notice that everybody, the majority of all the MPAs, move up into the minimum size range. In fact, there's really only 3 packages that have MPAs that are still a MPA that is still down below the minimum. Look at how many of the packages, the MPAs for 4 and 3 and 2 that are actually up in that preferred range now. Likewise, the external MPAs have moved way up into the preferred and the minimum level. Okay?
Just want to make a note here. One of the very important points of deliberation at the BRTF was a recognition on the part of the BRTF that some of the proposals may include MPAs with moderate high levels of protection, and that the BRTF would seriously consider such proposals and use all SAT-evaluated levels of protection. You just saw an illustration of the SAT-evaluated levels of protection. That same methodology, approach, and treatment of proposals will be deployed in round 3.
Yep. To summarize that quickly then, at the very highest level of protection, draft proposal 4 is the most consistent with the size guidelines. It had 1 reserve in the preferred size range. And this is important, too, when we start looking at some of the modeling results as to whether these proposals, the MPAs that were proposed, actually meet the guidelines and how that relates to the results generated by the models. draft proposal three had an intermediate fraction of reserves that met the guidelines. I'm not going to go into these details. Again, at the high protection, you see a greater fraction of MPAs moving into the minimum and preferred size range. And then at the moderate high level, as I said, nearly all of the MPA clusters now are starting to shift to that minimum size guideline. And four and three now have many of their clusters, many of their MPAs up in the actual preferred size range. So now let's turn to spacing quickly. And so again, the criteria here were that the MPA, in order to be this is very important because this is going to have a huge effect on the spacing analysis. Remember that for an MPA or a given habitat in an MPA to be considered in the network, right, to be considered when it came to measuring spacing, that the MPA had to meet that minimum size guideline of 9 square miles, and we had to characterize the habitats in each of those MPAs, and those habitats had to meet that minimum habitat area that we calculated as well, right? And then for each of those habitats, we measured the gaps between the adjacent MPAs of that met the size guidelines. So here's the graphic summary of those gaps. So the vertical axis shows you the maximum gaps for each of the packages, for each of the habitat type, and it shows, most importantly, where those guidelines are down at the base, right? So it's between 30 and 60 miles that you want your gaps to be below. And right off the bat, you can see that two of the packages, three and four, are right at the edge of the maximum gap. And package one is intermediate. Notice that packages two and external aren't close to that, but it's largely because their MPAs aren't meeting the size requirements to be included in the spacing analysis, okay? So you need to understand that when you're actually trying to estimate the distances or interpret these estimates. That was at the very high level of protection. That's just looking at the no-take marine reserves. Now let's drop down to the high protection. And now, essentially, what you've seen is that package one drops down into the maximum guideline level along with three and four, but packages two and four still aren't close to that because, again, the MPAs weren't big enough. But now let's consider the moderate to high level of protection, and now you see all of the packages dropping down well into the SAT guidelines for spacing. Let me see if I have any particular notes on that. Huh. And then, you know, there's some habitats like the soft bottom that for packages two and four never get into that spacing guideline. The deep soft bottom, 30 to 100 meters. And then there's others like surf grass habitat and that are, you know, so few and far between that that's probably as close as they can be clustered. Okie doke. So with respect to spacing, there's very high at the very high protection level, four and three, again, we're close to meeting those minimum or maximum gap guidelines. One, two, and the external greatly exceeded that. When you consider down, now let's consider the very high as well as, the high as well as the very high MPAs. And a similar sort of pattern, but one dropped down into meeting the guidelines. And then finally, as I mentioned, once we consider all of those MPAs that are moderate, high, and above, now four, three, and one are meeting the spacing guidelines for all of the habitats. And the maximum gaps are actually right in the middle of that recommended guideline. And two and the external are meeting the spacing guidelines for all the habitats except the two, sandy beaches and deep sand. So turning quickly to replication, remember that the guidelines there were, again, that the MPAs or clusters must meet that same minimum size criterion, the 9 square miles, and the habitat must meet that minimum threshold area that was presented to you earlier as well. And estuarine marine protected areas don't have to meet a minimum size guideline because they're not that big, but they do need to contain at least roughly a tenth of a square mile of estuarine habitat. And some of the small estuaries, you know, contain less than that tenth of a square mile of estuarine habitat. But again, protection of those estuarine habitats still has an important conservation value. So with respect to replication, the gray bars are the levels of replication for each of those habitats that were produced in the Central Coast study region. And that's why the gray bars are the same as you go from one package to the next, right? That doesn't change. Then what we did is we've shown you the additional replication that each of the proposals produce added on top of that replication. And what you see again is that for the most part, packages 1, 3, and 4 add on a substantive amount of replication, especially 3 and 4. They're essentially doubling the amount of replication at the very high level of protection, right? Whereas 2 and the external at the very high level of protection, again, because of the sizing guidelines, didn't add additional replication. If we drop down to the high level of protection, that replication tends to grow in packages 1, 3, and 4. And now you start to see a couple of replicates for one replicate for each of the habitats in packages 2 and the external. And then when we get down into thinking across the moderate, high, and very high MPAs all taken together, now you start to see a number of replicates that are being added on for each of these habitats across the board in all of the different packages. There's still substantial differences for some of these habitats, and some of them just can't be replicated very easily, especially surfgrass habitats, and so those will always be constrained. With respect to estuarine habitats, Most of the habitats have 3 to 5 new replicates, and that greater replication of there's even greater replication of eelgrass. That's the one that's the dark green down at the bottom. There's greater replication of that habitat in this study region than there was in the Central Coast, and this is strictly at the very high protection because there were no MPAs at the moderate, high, or high level of protection. Okay, so this is the summary of essentially of all the MPAs. And then this, so let's go back for a second. So this is the estuaries that are the large ones that met the minimum area. Now I'm going to add on top of that those estuaries that you captured that are too small to meet the minimum, and they crank up the replication even further. So in summary, with respect to replication, there still is marked differences, of course, among proposals. There's generally less replication in the central than the Central Coast study region at the very highest levels of protection. At the highest levels of protection, again, it was 4, had more than 1 and 3, which had more than 2 in external. But there's fewer differences among the proposals and more similarities to the Central Coast at that moderate high level of protection.
North Central Coast.
Yep. Yeah. What did I say?
Central Coast.
Okay. Thanks. But generally speaking, across the board, these estuarine habitats tend to be well replicated. Okay, now we're going to go to the last component of this presentation, which is sort of an introduction to and summary of the modeling efforts that the SAT has done to further provide parallel evaluation of these packages, right? And so remember, there's two models that the science advisory team has been developing. One is referred to EDOM, Equilibrium Delayed Difference Optimization Model or something. I can't remember. I probably made that up, okay? And that's the model that Carl and Chris and Ray had been developing. And then there's the model developed by Lou Botsford's group out of UC Davis. And so I'm going to present results from both of those modeling efforts. And what you'll find is that for the most part, they tend to sort of substantiate each other's results or predictions. I want to mention a couple of key traits of these models before we get into looking at some of the results. First of all, they're equilibrium models that predict the effects of MPAs into the future. So the idea here is that you set up these MPAs, the fish populations respond to it for several generations until they come to an equilibrium, a rather stable population size, and the values that we graph and compare are those values at the equilibrium state. And those can be way into the future given the life history of some of these species like rockfish. The models look at individual species and don't consider, you know, species interactions within ecosystems, okay? We're just looking at separate species and asking how are those species going to respond to the distribution and levels of protection that you guys have proposed. We can't, the models can't accommodate, you know, predator-prey interactions or competitive interactions resulting from changes in abundance by the MPAs. And then the levels of protection are not used in the models, right? So instead, it's sort of a species-by-species consideration of protection based on the MPAs that you produce. So, for example, if you have an SMCA that doesn't allow urchin fishing, then that would be considered an urchin protected MPA. If, on the other hand, it did allow urchin fishing, then it would fall into the urchin fishing level of protection, right? And so that's how these run. If for each of the individual species that we'll talk about in just a second, you simply consider what level of protection each of those species received based on the different levels of protection that the package is proposed. Both of the models assess a conservation value. They do it in two different metrics, right? The EDOM model looks at the abundance of a species across the region as a consequence of producing the network. The Davis model looks at the sustainability of the populations to replenish themselves across the region, right? They also look at economic return. The EDOM model will look at yield, and the Davis model looks at profit. There are responses for multiple representative species in combination. I'll show you a list of the species that were identified and the life history traits that were used. And then what they do is they run it for all those species and look at the combined or collective response of the species group to the proposed design. And they also look at different management actions. And this is what I'm saying there is a big part of this is look, and you'll see this has a huge effect on the results of these models, the level of fishing that occurs outside of these protected areas. And then finally, the models can incorporate eventually different responses of fishing, the distribution of fishing to the production of a network. But in this run, they're using a gravity model where they just move fishing effort weighted to where fish abundance tends to occur outside the MPAs, okay, which makes sense. Here's the list of species very quickly. There's about eight of them. And I just want to point out that we selected these species because they represent a gradient or a continuum of larval dispersal distances for species likely to benefit by the MPA system. So it ranges from 1 kilometer larval dispersal for abalone to 100 kilometers for cabezon. And then they also consider a continuum of home range distances of the adults, right? And again, that ranges from 1 I don't want to meet the abalone that marches a kilometer, but they also go up to what is a surprisingly mobile species, canary rockfish, who we have an estimated home range of about 40 kilometers in diameter. Okay, and the point of that is that then by that collection of diversity of life history traits, hopefully the results are reflective at least of the species that are likely to benefit from the MPAs, mostly obviously species that are being fished. So here's some insights, right? Here's just some summary, and then we're going to go into some graphic summaries. Increase, and this is kind of the no-brainer, increasing the size and decreasing the spacing, right, making them bigger and closer together, increases the conservation value. The relationship between conservation value and economic return depends on what happens outside the MPAs. So what we're going to do is show you how the fish populations and economic responses vary as a function of three levels of fishing. What is considered sustainable fishing, moderately overfished, and then very overfished. And the point of this is simply to say we don't know what's going to happen in the future, and how are these different MPA packages going to protect these populations as you vary across those levels of fishing mortality.
Mark, let me just interject here. When Steve Gaines presented this, he got a certain amount of pushback for his terminology of mm-hmm. unsustainable fishing. Again, I want to remind everyone, this is a model. These are three different scenarios, and Mark and his colleagues are not asserting that unsustainable fishing is happening. He's saying the model results depend upon model inputs and assumptions.
Right. So let me give you one example of the kinds of results that's generated. Now, this is just one that we're not really going to dwell on, but it's a neat product from the models, which is to predict how the biomass or the abundance of a species is going to vary along the coast. So this axis ranges from Point Arena, right, the northern boundary, down toward the southern boundary, and then on the vertical axis is the biomass of all those species we've been looking at collectively, right, and you see that it varies markedly, right, as you go down the coast, and that's a reflection of two things: whether the habitat's appropriate, right, whether it's rocky habitat or not for a rockfish, and whether it's in an MPA or not. And what it allows you to do as well is see the different colors on this graph are depicting those predictions for each of the different packages. And so in this case, you can see that those patterns of biomass tend to be quite similar geographically, right? They're in concert with one another. And especially here in this region, they're very similar to one another, whereas in this region, there's some substantial differences in the standing biomass. And so that'll be a nice result that we can compare the consequences of each of the packages. You can also use this to forecast. So we can forecast which configurations should lead to higher biomasses or more sustainable populations, which are the conservation value, and or which leads to higher yield or economic return. And then finally, we provide a basis for considering how to adjust MPAs in order to achieve a desired level of conservation or economics. But we're not doing that now, right? We're not going to use the models to monkey with the packages. This is just during this run, during this study region, we're going to use it to hopefully help evaluate the different packages. So what I've plotted here, I didn't plot this, somebody plotted this, is the sustainability level, right? The level of sustainable populations for each of the packages on the vertical axis as a function of the three different levels of fishing, right? So the little blue pluses are when you fish at a sustainable level. The red circles are moderate overfishing, and then the yellow squares are heavy overfishing. And so the pattern, the only real take-home message from this, and this is the results of the Davis model looking at the sustainability generated for these species by the different packages. First of all, if you look at the pluses where the fishing is being sustainable, they're all essentially the same, right? Because you're already fishing sustainably outside. Throwing in MPAs doesn't produce much additional sustainable value for sustainability. But as you start to increase fishing pressure, we move down to the moderate level with the red circles, you start to see a little bit of variation, right, falling out among the different packages. And particularly, you see package 4 standing out above the others. And then the others tend to be all very similar to one another. And then if you increase fishing into a heavy overfishing condition for a particular species, then 4 tends to be accentuated even that much more, and package 1 a little bit more relative to the others. Okay, so the bottom line there is, as you crank up fishing pressure, you start to see a little bit more difference in the conservation value of the different packages. Here's the results for the EDOM model, and they're similar. The scales are different because they're using a different metric on the bottom. This is abundance, and again, what you see is for the pluses, it's sustainable fishing. They're all relatively similar to one another with respect to the sustainable abundance that's produced. Then when you go down to moderate fishing, you start to see variation. Again, package 4 tends to stand out relative to the others. And then that just gets a bit more, it gets more accentuated as you increase fishing pressure that much more. So it's just a way to get a feel for, as you crank up or down the fishing pressure, how the packages respond relative to one another. This is in now we're going to flip and look at economic consequences, right? And so this is the Davis model, and the horizontal axis is economic value. And again, what you see is the pluses, right, which is fishing sustainably, are all really quite similar to one another. And in fact, if you increase the fishing to a moderate overfishing level, the economic value doesn't change much at all. And again, it's all very similar across the different packages. And it's not until you get into a scenario where you're really heavily overfishing that the one model that has the highest conservation value now also has the highest economic value. And that's simply a reflection of the fact that you've overfished everything outside, and what's sustaining the fishery is the spillover of adults out of those MPAs, okay, which is higher when you have bigger MPAs. And then if you look at the EDOM model, you tend to get a similar pattern, but notice again that for economic value and sustainable and moderate, and even at the heavy overfishing, there's not strong differences in changes in the economic value of those fisheries across those different packages. This is now taking, we only have a couple more figures here, okay? And then we can all go to the bathroom. This is taking those two axes, the conservation values that I showed you earlier and the economic values that I showed you earlier, and plotting them as a function of one or the other, okay? And what this allows you to do is look at the relative change in the economic value for a given change in the conservation value of each of your packages. And again, we've done it for each of the three different fishing levels. So, for example, what you tend to see in the state of a sustainable fishery, as I said before, the conservation value, they're all very high up there because they're not affecting the sustainability much, and there's some variation in the economic return as you overfish. Let me see if And so as you overfish, the conservation value drops down. The economic value, again, this is the cluster of your packages right here. This is the status quo value, right? And you can see how these are all much higher in conservation value for a marginal decline in economic value. And then finally, when you get to really high overfishing, you get really low. You get the same pattern again, where number four, which had the highest conservation value, also has the highest economic value, again, because of that spillover effect. Okay? So the differences really start to tease out, and they reverse as you get into with increasing fishing pressure. That was the Davis model. Here's the same thing for the EDOM model for the most part. Here are the packages under sustainable fishing, and both the relative conservation value and the relative economic differences, and again plotted relative to the status quo. If we increase the fishing to a moderate level, moderate overfishing, now you start to see marginally more differences between the packages. Remember, these packages over here are probably the external package, I believe, that had the lower conservation value but are having the higher economic value. And then finally, the same sort of thing where at heavy overfishing, it's the most conservative MPA that also produces the highest economic return. This, the models, importantly, can also be used to look at their sensitivity to the kinds of information and the values that we put into them. This is what's called a sensitivity analysis. And so what you can do, what we've shown you here, is for the biomass, the composite biomass, if we alter the larval dispersal range, if we half it, that's the 0.5 down here, or we double it at this end, you can look at how the rank of the packages differ, their biomass levels differ as we change those dispersal ranges. And what you see is there's a little bit of a change, but it never changes the ranking of the different packages across all those dispersal distances. Likewise, for the fishery value and the larval dispersal distance, you get the same pattern, that across the different larval packages, the economic return tends to be pretty insensitive, such that the rank, the relative height of the yellow, green, red, blue, are always the same across those larval ranges. And that's great. It tells us that that's not something that we have to be really concerned about in the model development. There are some sensitivities, which we've alluded to earlier, and that's illustrated here where we've plotted the percent difference from no action as a function of fishing pressure. And what this shows is that at high fishing pressure, remember, the percent difference from no action really starts to divvy out between the different packages, with the conservation model being much higher than the others. But as you move and you reduce fishing pressure and move down this curve to areas where there's very low fishing pressure, now you see that they actually reverse in their order. And there's far less variation among the different packages. So again, it just gives you a feel for how some parameters are really quite sensitive to changes in fishing pressure, and that's something that we really need to think about in interpreting the predictions, the long-term predictions of the models. So to close, the conclusions from these models is that the rank of the proposals in terms of their conservation value is relatively insensitive to key species differences, which is really interesting. That's something that I find completely non-intuitive, thinking that dispersal distance and movement distances would really affect the functioning of the MPAs and management actions as well. the rank of the proposals in terms of economic value is strongly dependent on the kind of management that goes on outside. In other words, the level of fishing, the fishing mortality that occurs outside. And as I showed you, the system will switch from a win-win situation. Under heavy overfishing, the package with the greatest conservation gave you the greatest economic return, to predictable trade-offs. When you're not overfishing at all, then the more you put into an MPA, i.e. the more conservation, the greater the reduction in economic return, right? And I think that's it.
Excellent, Mark. Thanks very much. You can see that lunch is being set up, and it's scheduled for noon. I suggest that we entertain questions on Mark's presentation in particular. And if there are questions on other briefings, we can consider those. But I think we ought to adhere to our schedule because we've let people know that there are public comments agendized, and we want to respect that. At the same time, this has been a long chunk of presentations, and I certainly recognize that. So we'll begin here at the main table and then go around. Tom Beatty.
Thank you, Mark. Am I on?
I believe
so. Can
you
hear me? Okay.
Yeah.
Yep. Thanks, Mark. I was hoping you could put us all on the same page regarding the designated level of protection for mariculture operations.
Uh-huh.
In your presentation, you were talking about it in terms of a moderate rating. Is that correct?
Right, right.
Okay. And then earlier in the morning, during Jason's presentation, Jason, you informed us from the SAT meeting on the 23rd of January that mariculture is given a low level of protection. So could we get on the same page? Is it a low or is it a moderate? Thanks.
What did he say?
Sorry. Mark, are you able to?
Did you
Jason?
Respond? I thought Jason. I'm going to look. I was wondering whether we added it to this.
Yeah, my understanding was that out of the last SAT meeting, they discussed further some mariculture activities, and the SAT voted unanimously to assign those as low.
It is. Okay. I'm sorry. In this table, it says low to moderate.
Okay. Just on some of your graphs, right. Maybe you're using old graphs then.
No, you're right. And it's that one graph that shows the relative levels of protection in the estuarine environment, and it says moderate, but you're right. It should be low moderate.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Let's continue around the table. Phil. Oh, Susan.
Thanks. I just want to point out that the evaluations that the SAT did were done in advance of the January 23rd decisions made by the SAT. So those decisions that were made by the SAT for levels of protection will be reflected in the final evaluations, but not necessarily in the ones that were done for this meeting.
Thank you, Susan. Let's continue around the table. Phil.
Thank you for that presentation. Second time I've heard it, and I have less of a headache this time. So, I'm sitting here in Dirk's seat, and he's a sea urchin diver. So I feel compelled to ask how the SAT developed a low level of protection for sea urchin diving when it's been has a track record of the longest running sustainable fishery in California.
Yeah, no, good question. And there's actually two aspects of that. Not only is it in the North Coast anyway a sustainable fishery, but you're removing a species that is thought to take out kelp beds, right? I mean, you're kind of a keystone predator if you think about it. You're as fuzzy as a little otter. And so on the face of it, it looks like it's the kind of activity that would not be considered detrimental to a rocky reef ecosystem. And the reason that it received the low-level designation is because that activity changes that ecosystem, right? So without making that value judgment of whether urchins are a good thing or a bad thing, you end up changing the abundance of a species that's thought to be a really important interactor in that system. And that really is a key criterion by which the levels of protections are determined. You know, how much is at any given activity, regardless of how we value it, how much is that activity going to change that ecosystem relative to the absence of that activity? And so that's why
it's sort of a non-intuitive consequence.
Clarifying addition, go ahead.
So what you're saying is that even though removing sea urchins could have a beneficial effect on the kelp, because it changes something in the ecosystem, it drops to a low.
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Good. Thank you very much. I want to jump back to Rick Johnson, then I'm going to come back to Josh and go around the table. Rick.
Hi. Yeah, I wanted to just talk about the modeling a little bit. At the January 23rd meeting, there was discussion about the some of the results seemed unusual given what we knew about the packages, and I volunteered to do some quality assurance audit of the models and to see if I could understand that, and I sent some information to the SAT. So one question I have is that useful for the SAT? And then following on to that, the, one of the important findings had to do with, I finished with the EDOM model, I haven't finished with the other one, had to do with the way the habitat is described, and it makes a big difference in the model results based on how well the habitat is mapped into the models. So I'm not sure what was used for these charts that we just looked at, but I'm interested to know if that information was useful for the SAT, and then what habitat mapping is going to be used.
Thanks. Mark?
Yep. So a couple of responses. To the first point, I haven't looked at the information that you submitted to the SAT, but I would argue that we're always interested in getting input, right? So it's going to be useful. Someone's going to look at it and take it into consideration. So my recommendation is to keep doing whatever additional analyses you are doing, and if you think you're providing us some insights that we haven't considered, then be sure to keep sending that stuff our way. I mean, we've received some great input from fishermen and other issues already. The with respect to the distribution of habitat, my understanding is that I know the EDOM model maps habitat at the 1 kilometer square pixel. And so for each 1 square kilometer, there is either rock or soft bottom habitat. And that's the highest resolution that we have.
Yeah, the issue with EDOM was all the unmapped shallow habitat. And so what I did is I made a sort of a judgment based on the maps to just go through and assign what looked like, you know, should be there. And that gave a distribution of biomass that looked a little more reasonable. And so, and Carl Walters thought that looked pretty good too. And even better would be to recalculate that using what the SAT is using of linear miles for the shallow. But I haven't gotten to the other models, so I don't know what they're using. But there is so much unmapped habitat
in shallow
water that
Yeah, no, that's useful. Thanks.
Good point. Let's continue around the table here, Josh.
Yeah. I was interested in your, overfishing being the highest value of, in all things, in the worst case scenario. But it seems like the SAT is taking the worst case scenario, where right now, I would say we have the lowest level of fishing that I've ever seen in my, 40 years of fishing around here. So you're saying basically that the smallest proposal actually has the same benefit as the highest proposal in the current situation that we have now.
Right, so
which is, we don't have overfishing right now. We have underfishing, if we have anything.
Right, so whatever the state is now, you could fit into any of those scenarios that we put up there, and then then that's the point of doing it.
Right.
Is so, that now, because now what you guys can do is think about, well, given the relative levels of fishing, but whether it's now or whatever that might be in the future.
Might be zero in the future. It looks kind of like we're heading that way. But
what
anyway.
I would suggest, I mean, obviously these models, sorry, I can't really see you, Josh. These models present a rich sort of arena for discussion about inputs and assumptions. And obviously there were some fairly simple assumptions necessarily made to show distinctions. But if you have suggestions for Mark about better assumptions, refining them, making them more explicit. I encourage you to talk to him while he's here.
I do. I have a, just bear with me for a second here.
Okay.
The BRTF basically gave us this. They're not interested unless we have broad interest support.
They're much more interested if you have broad interest support.
Okay.
Say that.
And at the same time, they want very high protection levels. And what the SAT has done is they're not showing the flexibility they're asking from us, and nor are you showing much compassion.
Well, the I'm just
speaking from the heart here.
Right. Well, so Mark doesn't have to defend himself.
No, I'm not asking for a defense. I'm just saying that you guys have set on a lot of arbitrary stuff. You know, you're calling it good science, but it's really best guess. Mm-hmm. All these movements and patterns and all that stuff. You don't know. You got to admit you don't know a lot of this stuff. And you're setting the bar really, really high. And you're terrifying a bunch of us.
Well,
so I'm just...
Josh,
just
I would just...
bear with me on it. That's all, you know. I'm just saying, you guys have set this thing so high that, you know, I don't... You see the empty seats.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, and hopefully what we're going to do is generate results like we did today that give across that gamut of whatever level of fishing may occur, you guys can look at what the response of these packages are going to be. We're not saying what the level of fishing is or is going to be in the future
right.
at all.
Well, it seems like you guys are assuming that we have this incredibly high level of fish over the whole area is overfished.
No,
if that was the case, then we would have never plotted the sustainable fishing levels.
I mean, I think it's important. The introduction of the parallel processes element in the SAT is an enrichment and a complication. The core methodology that Mark presented on initially was really size and spacing and replication, and that is the core on which the BRTF will make its evaluation. At the request of some SAT members, as I understand it, Jason and others who are familiar, there was an effort made to really test these other models, and necessarily there is a need to make assumptions about fishing effort outside MPAs to run those models. But, you know, Josh, to your point, the BRTF's guidance, I don't think, constrains you to one flavor of MPA or one flavor of proposal, but there is a suite of, and that's the word I would use, there is a suite of advice here from the BRTF, and I really would counsel all of you to take all of that advice into account, including the backbone as reserves, including the inclusion of moderate high, including the evaluation of socioeconomic consequences. Those are all part of the mix. And so I think there's a weighing and balancing that the BRTF is inviting the regional stakeholder group to make, and they'll make their own balancing as well. So I don't know if that's a satisfying response, Josh, but I just want to say the SAT is not assuming a massive level of overfishing. That's not fundamental to the analysis that Mark is presenting. Is that fair, Mark?
Yeah, absolutely, because, Josh, the point is that whoever is making these interpretations, it's not the SAT, right? When it comes to thinking, what do you think the level of fishing is and is going to be in the future, the BRTF and the Commission are more than welcome to consider that those pluses. The fishing is at sustainable levels, right? And then based on that, what are the differences that you see across those packages? Right. And you saw that there weren't many differences in some of those analyses.
Right.
So we're making sure that they have that perspective as well as what might happen if things go to hell.
Right. Let's take a couple more questions if we can before lunch and continue around the table. Ken.
I would just like a clarification. Have they ever considered perhaps judging, or the way they set these things up, judging differently the inshore fishing from, or I should say shorebound fishing, separate from offshore fishing? And the reason I say that, one of my friends here this morning, we were talking, you know, he said he had a great day the other day out commercial fishing, caught 1,100 pounds of fish that day. Great day. One of my other friends who runs a party boat said, you know, when they go out to a certain spot, they expect to catch 20 or 30 limits of fish, 600-700 fish. And then we have a 3-mile-long beach, which might have 3 surf fishermen who are catching 3 fish each. So not a lot of fish there. And so sometimes we think, it, you know, they should be judged like apples and oranges. It's a whole totally different way of fishing, and the amount of fishing and the amount of fish that are caught are quite different. Yet it seems like the way that the scores are set up, it's the same method.
Yeah,
and it doesn't quite seem logical.
Well, let me respond to that. So you're right. I mean, currently there's no question. There's no comparison between the fishing mortality that shore fishing causes relative to people, you know, cruising, fishing from vessels, right? The problem is that we don't, and this came up in a discussion about mariculture as well, right? We don't know what the future level of any of these fishing activities are going to be. Ask Josh, they're going to go way down, right? And so we don't know whether fishing levels, whether it's shore fishing or vessel-based fishing, is going to go up, it's going to go down. It's certainly not a restricted access fishery. And so we have to assess the level of protection based on whatever is being potentially removed, right? I mean, and that's purely a function of what kinds of species, what number of species constitute a fishery, rather than what's the current relative level of fishing or mortality of these different activities.
Good.
Can I ask one follow-up question?
Yeah.
Based upon that, you know, the assumption seems to be that we should always shoot for the highest level, and one of the goals is, of the group here is always try to get the highest scores, and it seems like we want to try to figure those things in. But would the SAT team agree that, given the different situations between inshore fishing and offshore fishing, that maybe in some cases the highest score is not necessarily the best solution, looking at all the different parameters of what's involved in that?
But see, we don't do that. That's what we assume is the role of the commission and the task force, right? It's their role, and we try and inform that role when we look at these relative economic impacts, for example, relative to the conservation value. But they're the ones that have to sit and make value judgments of whether they think mariculture or shore fishing or crabbing or whatever has societal value that overrides the extent of these networks of MPAs.
But the score you assign does tend to drive the different proposals we have.
Yeah,
right?
But one thing you'll see, I understand and I appreciate that point, but one thing that you'll see is that right. At the same time, especially in the Central Coast process, regardless of those levels of protection, those were taken into consideration. Those impacts on those activities were taken into consideration by the task force and the commission, where areas were set aside out of an MPA to allow shore fishing.
Right. Just to elaborate, so I think a simple answer to your last question, Ken, is that the SAT methodology does not capture those kinds of distinctions that you believe attach to shore fishing. However, the overall methodology looking at fish and game feasibility analysis and the consideration of socioeconomic impacts might be able to take those into account in a different way, and you really have an opportunity in writing your round three proposals to explain why you have made a choice, if you do, in a particular MPA to not have it be a reserve and to not have it be the very high level of protection. So there is absolutely a way in this process to account for that.
One very short just statement follow-up then is that that's true. However, when we received direction from the Blue Ribbon Task Force that they would like to see, you know, higher scores, that really puts the members of this group in a quandary as to how far really can we push
right.
that.
It's a balancing act. Mike, I just want to say we have Mike, we have Bob, we have Patricia and Christopher, and then we're going to break for lunch.
Yeah, Mark, thanks a lot. I can see you did a lot of work on this stuff. But what concerns me is your last graphs that you had on there with the win-win situation. You seemed pretty solid that's the way it's going to work. I think you should have a big question mark on your thing, because my experience of 49 years at sea, I mean, you have El Ninos, you've got upwellings, you've got no forage fish, lots of forage fish. You got your cycles. Here comes the Humboldt squid, which had just showed up. You got the sardines that have showed up in the last 8 or 10 years. No krill. They kind of went away when the sardines came. And then you have, of course, your expanding mammal population, which is going to – they're going to whack these places too, you know, as things go along. So I think you need to put some of those variables into your final thing.
Well, your comments really reflect Josh's comments earlier. And again, and that's the point, is that that little win-win scenario, remember, only occurred when there was heavy overfishing, right? And so to the extent that you think we'll never be there again, right, which is highly possible, then you may not run into that scenario, and that win-win scenario is not as relevant as those other scenarios where we're talking trade-offs now, right, between conservation. And so don't think just because one end of the modeling results suggested a win-win situation means that that's the one that we're gravitating to.
Right. I would just make another observation. You know, the size and spacing methodology took a lot of time to get even to its current state, and it is obviously still evolving, as we can see. It may be that these models, the nomenclature used and how they're presented, is not quite ripe for this conversation. You know, I think we're seeing that by some of the reaction that we've gotten last at the BRTF and today. And so it's useful, it's illustrative, it might not quite get us to where we need to be to tee up a policy deliberation.
Yeah, but I will make the comment. The reason those terms happen to be used, instead of simply saying fishing mortality of 0.4, fishing mortality of 0.35, fishing mortality of 0.6, those terms that we use are the council fisheries terms associated with those levels of fishing mortality. Right, so when we say sustainable fishing, if you look at the axis along there, it's on the order of about 0.45 of the pristine biomass, and that's what NOAA Fisheries fishes. That's what they're targeting for sustainable fishing mortality, and so that's why we used those particular terms. Those are the NOAA terms for those different levels that were plotted on that axis. That's all.
Thank you. Bob?
I have just two comments. The first one is, as to modeling, it was the fishing community that pressed up in here to have those models. You've got them. You can play with them now. My comment has to do with a non-model issue. Has to do with estuarians. And I looked at – we're doing pretty good on estuarian, except – this morning, we were told, for example, that at Drake's Estero, which is the big one, that almost all of our current proposals have very high or high protection there. Added the mariculture, it's going to go to low. So our estuarian stats now are going to take a huge drop, because that was our primary estuary, I think, in terms of space, wasn't it?
Yeah, definitely. But the high levels of protection that most of those packages received was based on statements in the proposals that mariculture was not going to continue, correct?
That's right.
Right.
After 2012.
Right, right. So those aren't changing, right? If you've said, when you and I think Susan made this comment earlier, when you identify the criteria for your state marine reserve that's going to be shut down or the lease will be terminated at the end of that, then we automatically gave that the high level of protection. That, and all of them were across there. I mean, there was large levels of protection. There was the one exception was the one package that said, no, we're not going to ask these guys to shut down.
Gotcha. Okay.
Good. Thank you. Patricia?
I'm going to shift gears here. My question's for Evan. You gave us guidance about being more specific about activities allowed. Should we now address non-consumptive activities? This came up in the workshop. Should we now be really focused and say what type of non-consumptive activities should be allowed in our MLPAs that we're proposing?
So that's a good question. I'm going to actually defer it to Susan here. This has to do with kind of special closures. My thought is that no, not at this point, but I think Susan can clarify a little bit.
So you're agreeing? Okay. So let me try this, if I may. The focus, the primary focus in creating these proposals is on delineation of MPAs. So you should stay with the guidelines that we gave you on MPAs. When we go to talking about special closures, then recreational uses allowed or not would be relevant, but not in the context of discussing MPAs. Correct? Good. Christopher, you get the last word, then we're going to lunch.
Ooh, lucky me. So you mentioned that there was a little bit of backlash on the term overfishing, and I can certainly see that. I'd like to point out that a high level of fishing effort or fishing activity doesn't necessarily indicate overfishing. And more importantly, from a conservation standpoint, a low level of return can actually be indicative of a low level of return or low level of fishing effort doesn't necessarily mean that an activity is sustainable. In fact, a low level of return can actually be indicative of a problem, which is why we're all here in the first place.
Good. Thank you very much. Jay, really, really the last word.
Yeah, just on Christopher's comment, with the way the regulations are right now, the low level of take is mainly a lot to do with the regulation changes that were in effect right now. So the numbers in the long term, if you ran a chart for the last 20 years, the numbers are going to be decreasing because of the regulation changes that are in effect right now. Thanks.
Good. Thank you very much. Samantha, really, really, really the last word.
Sorry. This will be very brief. It's a lob. It's just a clarifying question to Evan, actually. I noticed that when you were giving your presentation on some of the new things that we want to outline in our templates for proposals, you mentioned gear restrictions, increased information on that. And I know that for salmon, the reason we differentiated between trolling and mooching was because they enjoy different protection levels. But, I mean, do we really have to... Because I thought, getting into gear types, I thought some of that was sort of outside our purview under the MLPA. So do we need to... I saw a photo of those little crab lassos that people use from piers. Do we need to really get into differentiating what kind of gear can be used in certain MPAs?
This is probably more a department question than for me, but I'd say that if that's your intent to differentiate between those, then that's appropriate. But if you just assume that it's the most restrictive or least restrictive basing on how you frame it, I guess what I'm saying is that if you say no take is allowed except for these specific activities and be specific about gear types, and those will be taken into account. If you say no take is allowed except for specific activities and don't specify gear types, then they'll assume that you're talking about all of them. Is that accurate, Susan, or do you want to clarify?
We can probably talk about this a little more this afternoon when we talk about feasibility analysis. So in recognition of the many members of the public who have come with the intention of giving public comments, I would like to adjourn for lunch now. Let's reconvene just before 1 o'clock, so 5 minutes to 1.
I have a quick announcement for the public.